Glad to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're going to kind of continue talking weather, but probably expand quite a bit here as we visit with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, and Professor John Martin, who chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW in Madison. Steve, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
John, nice to have you back,
too. Yeah, thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
Look at him all decked out in his Boston stuff.
Did you get much sleep last night?
I got a little bit. It was all this morning, actually. What a great season. Best team in the land. No doubt about it.
Not for this year, anyway.
Yeah, for this year.
For years to come.
The Brewers will be in next year.
And they'll lose to the Red Sox then, but it'll be more difficult to cheer then.
Well, I tell you, we just finished a very interesting conversation with Tim Isley about the Armistice Day storm of 1940, where, you know, the temperatures were in the 60s in the morning and dropped to 7 below, I think 8 below zero in just a matter of a few hours.
Amazing. And then the wind chill on top of that?
I mean, it's 60 to 90 mile an hour winds.
And what an event.
And I think the snow drifts got up 27, 28 feet.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of little interesting connections that, you know, I mean, all these other facts are just mind-boggling. But, you know, I heard you talking about and saying that there was like 2 million turkeys that were killed. Mm-hmm. So a little interesting fact that goes with that is that a week before that, or 2 weeks before that, when Roosevelt was just reelected as president, he decided to move Thanksgiving Thursday back a week. So it used to be the second week in November, and then they moved it to the third week in November in order to give the turkey growers more time in order to fatten up the turkeys to sell them.
Wow.
And then what happens? Boom. It comes and it kills them all.
Yeah. Amazing.
Oh, man. Well, that story, I don't think that would happen today where you'd get that many people caught unawares.
Yeah, actually, it's really kind of interesting, and I'm saying it because I'm writing an article about satellites, and the way that I'm comparing it is I'm looking at the 1940 storm, the 1975 storm that sunk the Edmund Fitzgerald, and then the storm in 1998, which was pretty much the same type of storm. In fact, it was much stronger than the Edmund Fitzgerald storm.
That's true.
And then looking at how the forecasts changed from 1940 to 75 and then 98. And in 40, of course, it took a lot of people by surprise. And it's not just the weather forecasting that improved and the data, but also the communication of getting things out there. In 75, they did a pretty good job of forecasting the storm. They just kind of had the position wrong. So every time they had to update, they were always saying, whoop, the storm is
moving
in a different direction and stronger than we thought. And by 98, man, they nailed that storm.
That thing was extraordinarily well forecasted. Yeah, that's right.
And nobody died.
Yep. And nobody died. And unfortunately, there were a lot of people dying in those earlier storms. The other storm we were talking about was the Children's Blizzard of 1888.
Yeah, I read that book. It's a good book.
Laskin's book. David Laskin wrote a book where the kids were sent home because the weather was going to be – it was turning bad, but then it just hit.
Yeah,
and 100 kids in the Dakotas in that area lost their lives in that blizzard going home.
Oh, man.
That was an amazing event, too. That started out with one of those warm mornings as well, and it turned into something that was bitterly cold and heavy snow, zero visibility. Mm. Amazing.
I tell you what, we can talk about more than those storms, too, with our guests here, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our weather guys. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Anything climate and weather, we're happy to talk about it. And Ernest in Reedstown is online. So let's go to Ernest. Hi.
Hello. Good morning, gentlemen. I have a question concerning the flooding here in the Kickapoo Valley. I've been here for 30 years and got here to witness the 78 flood, where just massive amounts of water, rain, you know, like 8 inches in 6-8 hours. It seems to occur on an 8 to 10 year cycle in this area for some reason. I just don't recall. Because of the typography here, of course, it all collects in the valley and floods everything out. Mm. But I don't see other areas where where that high a number of water falls in such a short period of time over such a, this last one was actually quite a large area. It just moved in here, rained all day Saturday, backed up, and about 11:30 at night, it shook the house when it fell, and just destroyed everything in the valley. But it occurred in, I think they call them 100-year floods, but I've witnessed at least three since I've been here in 30 years.
This was in August, I'm thinking. You're probably referring
to, is
that right?
August 18th,
Yeah, that was an amazing wet period for the entire southern part of the state. That was really quite remarkable, and we're beginning to take a look at that and try to understand how some of the influences that might have resulted in that. One of them may have been a decaying tropical storm over Texas. I forget the name of it now off the top of my head, but that thing fed into the flow that dragged quite excessive amounts of water vapor in the atmosphere northward, and then there was a variety of disturbances that was able to wring it out in terms of the heavy rain. I think what's interesting in what you said, in addition, of course, to the flooding that goes on in those valley areas around the Kickapoo River, is that, you know, widespread, one might report that this is a 100-year flood and 100-year total rain. I think 15 inches of rain in something like a week. I think we got that week. That is probably only going to happen once every 100 years. But if you're in that mountainous or hilly terrain right near the river, even half that amount of rain, which is probably, of course, going to happen quite a bit more frequently, is going to be enough to give you a flood that you remember. So you get, in those 100 years, you're punctuated by maybe 3-4 of those events, and they don't all have to come with 15 inches of accumulated rain because of the topography. As you point out, it all floods right into the river. So very devastating rains.
But if you take a look back at their monster numbers, 78, I was, when it hit here, probably the blackest sky I'd ever seen. I was in Westby. It took me an hour and a half to come the less than 20 miles here, and I was running in water up bumper deep going uphill, steep hills coming into Viroqua.
Well, Ernest, that's not such a good thing to do. Because when you're into bumper type of water, it doesn't take much more deeper before your car becomes a boat without a rudder.
And without much buoyancy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
you just kind of move along. They have it for a short time. They don't have it for very long.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. And Mark in Onalaska, I think, is next. So let's go to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, I heard you mention the different storms, and the one that comes to mind is the Halloween storm back in 91.
Oh, yeah.
Which I was out in, and that would have been a lot worse on the river, except at 91, rather than 41, people had outboard motors and got back. Because they were waiting till the last minute, and the timing was just right at dusk.
Yeah, and if I recall, it wasn't quite as bitterly cold behind the wind shift in association with that storm either. I think that even places like Duluth that had, what did they have, like 50 inches of snow or something on that storm? I think the temperatures stuck into the high 20s for a very long time in association with that event, a little bit earlier in the year. But, yeah, the onset and their tremendous wind shifts and weather sort of changes, sensible weather changes associated with that were quite dramatic. Meanwhile, the first President Bush's vacation home in Kennebunkport was getting destroyed by the so-called perfect storm on the same day on the East Coast, and that got all the press.
Okay. That's why that sounds so familiar.
That got all the press, but the really exciting event from my perspective happened in the central United States that day.
So was that forecast well?
The Halloween storm 91, I don't recall, actually, because I wasn't living here at the time. So
It was 65 degrees out, and everybody thought, well, what can happen? It's still October.
Be careful.
Yeah. Be careful. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Tom in Mequon, I think, is next. So let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I had a question concerning clouds, in that I was wondering, is there a website I could go to view clouds like real time, like say at an hour interview to see them coming, you know, from the west or east or whatever, but I'd like to see the clouds as they come over the state. Is there a website like that I could go to?
I'm going to give you two. One is from a satellite perspective, and so that website would be www.ssec.wisc.edu. And then when you come to that main page, you'll see something like data and images. And if you click on that, then you'll have options to go and look around for the nation or for Wisconsin. And that'll give you the big picture of what's going on. The other thing is, you know, cameras that sit up on top of buildings. And I'm not sure how you search for those, but I would go for like a local news channel place because a lot of them usually put those cameras up someplace.
Yeah, that's right. They do do that a lot.
And that's more, that are going to be much more localized. And not clearly not every city is going to have one of those.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, I'm looking for a top view. I'm looking, you know, not from a ground view. I'm looking for, you know, on top so I could see, like, you know, like say, for instance, I'm in Madison. I look to the south and I see some huge storm clouds. And I'm wondering, like, you know, where are they? Are they like at the Illinois border, or are they like in, you know, above Kenosha, or, you know, whatever? Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see a satellite view to see really where they are at that moment or close, you know.
Yeah, then you want to go to that SSEC website, the Space Science and Engineering Center website. They got a great collection of satellite images.
So that's ssec.wisc.edu.
But first, www.ssec. If you don't have that in there, it's not going to find it. I don't know why, but yeah, that's kind of...
Usually it does.
I know it does, but whenever I type it in, it doesn't find it. So give that a try, Tom.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Tim and Eau Claire, hi to you.
I got a quick question for you guys. I live in Eau Claire. I've lived here for most of my life, but I've lived in a couple other towns around. And I've noticed that Eau Claire seems to get less storms actually hit the town of Eau Claire than any surrounding communities. It always seems like the storm goes north or the storm goes south, or a couple times I've seen it on the radar where it is headed straight for us and goes right around us, both directions.
So do you mean like thunderstorms or?
Thunderstorms, or even I've noticed, I'm not sure if you guys have ever seen this, where one person on one side of the street gets a downpour and the person on the other side of the street doesn't get a proper.
I've seen that a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that in Colorado a lot.
Actually, on our property itself, our property line, right down the middle of our street during thunderstorms, half the time you could see that our house gets completely drenched and our neighbor who lives up the hill, his lawn doesn't get a drop of rain.
That's weird.
So do you like storms or not?
Yeah.
Oh, I love storms.
Well, that's why they're not coming to us.
That's exactly what I was going to ask.
When I lived in a small town south of here in Mondovi, we had storms all the time. And then it seems like as soon as I moved away from there, I still see the storms on the radar. I still see everything happen except for it doesn't hit Eau Claire.
All right, Tim, now I'm going to say something in follow-up to Steve's question. He asked it for one reason. I would have asked the same question for another reason. There are people in this town who complain about exactly the same thing. Right, in Madison. Yep. Complain about exactly the same thing. And to a person, they are interested in seeing those storms. So I got a feeling here's what's going on. Because there's no good logical explanation for it meteorologically, why Eau Claire should be the place where the Red Sea parts and the storms. Really, I mean, I'm not making fun of your comment, because I have the exact same view of what happens here in Madison. How many times am I looking forward to this thing rumbling through, and it seems to just decay right over the central part of Dane County, gets reorganized as it gets further east, and it just drives me crazy. I got a feeling it's because the level of anticipation is so high for people with an eye on the weather that they notice every single event that does that.
That does it, that misses you. Yeah,
yeah, and it's easier to catalog and remember those because they're like thorns in your meteorological side than it is to remember the ones that actually come to fruition.
Well, I have noticed, could it be topography? Because I was noticing that it seems like they start to break up as soon as they cross what we call the Knapp Hill, which is a fairly large area of hill, and then, you know, it's a good 20 miles away, but it seems like that's where the split starts.
There can be a role played by even small hills such as that, especially if the air that's feeding the storm is really, if the whole thing's being fed by air in the lowest part of the atmosphere. That can be a factor. You bet.
Weather Guy's with us today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking climate and weather now with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Really pleased to have them with us. They're both with the University of Wisconsin-Madison, of course. You can join in with your question at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Lots of people online, so let's just go right back to the phones here and to Robert in Rhinelander. Robert, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. I was just wondering if you guys had any information on the 1977 Fourth of July storm. It's probably the most vivid storm in my living memory, and I was living in Tomahawk at the time, and it was a clear blue sky. There wasn't a cloud. There wasn't nothing, you know, and then a green line appeared on the horizon, and it hit just so quick. I was just wondering if you guys had any records of official wind speed or anything like that. I know for years afterwards, you could drive from Tomahawk to Minocqua, and you could just see trees laying flat in rows.
Yeah, two things that come to mind. One is when you describe it as a, you know, the green sky coming. I mean, whenever you see a green sky, you know nasty weather is following very shortly.
You got big hailstones in the sky is what it means.
Yeah,
it's refraction through the ice. So they got, I think they probably have to be as big at least as a golf ball before you start to see it really look green.
Yeah.
And that's pretty scary.
Yep.
And if you don't, suspend a golf ball-sized piece of ice in the atmosphere unless you've got a really strong updraft of air, and that is part of the way that you can measure the intensity of a storm as well. The stronger the updraft, the more intense it is. But I think we just referenced some documents that suggested the wind speeds were in the 80 to 100 mile per hour range associated with that thing.
Wow.
So, and this is not that uncommon. I mean, that kind of intensity probably happens once every 10 years or so, but these kind of storms happen in the late, the early part of the summer, right after the solstice, quite a bit in the northern part of Minnesota and the northern part of Wisconsin. And people have referred to this as the so-called ring of fire, and they mean that it's a region of anticyclonic flow up in the northern part of the states that is just scattered with this extremely strong convective activity and knocks down woods in the boundary waters. Just about every year you hear something like that.
And a guy from the Weather Service has said that a 70-mile-an-hour wind can knock a semi right off the road. So, and you've got 80 to 100 miles, and I even have read 140-mile-an-hour winds. That's a lot of wind.
That can sandblast your house. I mean, you can take paint off your house. If there's a little bit of dust in the air, it'll just sandblast your house, that kind of wind speed. Amazing.
I remember it had just snapped big white pines that were nearly 100 feet tall right off. I had gotten home that afternoon after the storm had passed, and my dad had said that it looked like the clouds were rolling about 30 feet up over the house like barrels rolling overhead. And it just snapped the trees right off at about that height and threw them maybe 50, 75 feet.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's when you see that kind of rolling cloud, that's either called it's part of the gust front, and sometimes it's called an arc cloud. And it's an indication of where the peak of the outflow of that storm is, and that's where the winds are just rushing really quick, and it's actually picking up low-level moisture, moist air from the ground and feeding that into the storm, and that's what allows it to maintain itself. I mean, these storms can go from Minnesota all the way across to New England, you know, with 80-mile-per-hour winds.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that strong downdraft is carrying that very strong momentum air, too. That's what drags the air of 80 or 100-mile-per-hour winds to the surface. Because those winds exist in the middle and upper part of the troposphere, but in those downdrafts and those thunderstorms, that's what drags that very high-speed wind to the surface.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Bob. Appreciate it. Mark in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hello. See, I got a question. I'm originally lived around the Comfrey-St. Peter area, and I was wondering that tornado that came through, I think it was 95, 96, and I was wondering if that was one of the strongest tornadoes on record, or is there anything stronger in this area?
I don't know if I remember that. I'm thinking of the Oakfield tornado that was about that year. Is it roughly in your part of the state? I don't know.
I think we lost our caller.
Too bad. That Oakfield tornado, if that was related to the outbreak that the call is referring to, that was an F5 tornado, I believe. And that was a serious tornado. That's about as strong as they get. But I honestly don't know if that was the same event.
Yeah. I mean, the big ones are the Oakfield and the Barnfield.
Barnabell, June of 84.
Those are the two biggest ones. So.
And Oakfield was in June of 96, I think.
So, yeah, I don't think it was in 91.
It would be in the same time.
Was it 90? Oh, yeah.
96?
Did you say 94, 95?
Yeah. I thought he said 95, 96. Okay.
Shows you how much we listen.
We miss that. Lois in Oconomowoc, we'll turn to you then. Hi, Lois.
Hi. I want to talk about the value-laden terms that weather, especially local weather people use when they describe rain or rainy weather as being miserable. We should be thankful when we get rain. And it kind of grates on me when weather people do use negative terminology when they describe that kind of weather.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. You know, I will completely agree, but not in the summertime. I don't look forward to, 5 days in a row of rain. I think in August they were appropriately using that word by the time we get to the end of that wet week. But I don't like it when and this happened a lot when I was a boy growing up in Massachusetts. It seemed like the weathermen were trying to talk storms out to sea in the wintertime, and they would diminish their potential impact. And it used to drive me crazy. So I agree. I think I would rather have a non-editorial approach to the weather and simply describe what's likely to occur next and actually add a little bit about why you think that. And that's it. But no editorializing. I agree.
Yeah, what do you think, Steve?
Actually, I don't really care. But what I'm thinking of is we often personalize storms to try to give them human characteristics. You know, so like when we talk about storm systems, we talk about their life cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, they're born and then they mature and then they have adolescence. You know, so that, you know, maybe that's what we're always making value judgments.
And we name the hurricanes.
We name the hurricanes people's names. Yep.
Yeah. So. Jim in Darlington, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I really appreciate this program today.
Thank you.
Because I spent 4 years in the United States Air Force in the Air Weather Service.
Oh, excellent.
And in 51 and 52, I was in Korea. And we got all of our, what little weather we got out of Manchuria. And that was about the only reporting station we had. So the forecasting there was very interesting. And I really appreciate what you're doing today.
Well, thank you very
thanks
much.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling.
Thank you.
Weather coming out of that area is really getting a lot of attention now, too, because it's coming out of that whole China area. Now that we have satellites and we can really see the big scale.
Yeah, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. And you bring out a lot of dust, comes off of that mainland and comes into the Korean Peninsula and Japan, and eventually sometimes finds its way over here in North America.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. Helen in Mountain, your turn now. Hi, Helen.
Oh, I love this program. This is simply wonderful. We had a tornado this past June. I believe it was June 7th at 5:10. We were in it, and it blew. I guess it went like 36 miles long, half mile wide. And the amazing thing, we just built a new home, a Frank Lloyd Wright style, with a very large overhang. And we were down in the wine cellar, and I was just certain the whole roof was being ripped off. But you guys, it spared our house and took out three different 50-year-old pine plantations all the way around that. It was just unbelievable.
Wow.
And I'm wondering, what we were hearing was all these pines snapping off. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with this storm, what we would classify as, and is this something that we're going to be seeing more of? Like, I think you're psychic, but just kind of wondering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't remember this storm off the top of my head, but I'll tell you one thing. When you describe those dimensions about the path length and the width, that's an extremely unusual tornado for the state of Wisconsin. I think the average path length is on the order of 5 miles, and the average width is a few hundred feet. So to have something that's half mile wide and stays in the ground for 36 miles is really an exceptional storm. And I'm wondering if it's not the flat roof of the Frank Lloyd Wright style home that maybe keeps things from getting a little bit elevated near the structure, and maybe that preserves the roof on such a house.
Yeah.
So,
well, we felt very, very fortunate. And of course, all the builders, the sheetrock guy said it was his work, the builders said it was their work, the plumbers said it was they all came to check. It was really funny. Do you see this more frequently in our area now, or is this pretty average?
I don't think it's frequent.
Yeah, no, I think it's pretty average. I mean, the number of tornadoes that we get up here in the state of Wisconsin is about 20, and it really fluctuates from year to year. So I don't think we've seen anything yet that indicates, you know, we're getting them more frequently or less frequently.
Hmm. Thank you.
But I think actually this the track of that is you can see that on satellites. This is one of those cases where you get it long enough, a trail, and it was wide enough that actually we looked at satellite images and you could actually see the path.
Wow.
You know, after it went by, it did such destruction.
Huh.
Wow.
Thanks, Helen.
Thank you.
Stephen Grafton, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi. My question kind of ties into the last, but I'm more concerned with precipitation and the possibility of heavier precipitation with climate change in the Midwest and southeastern Wisconsin in particular. As far as civil planning goes for engineering of runoff and flood control structures, typically the information relied on has been past events. Is there consensus on what climate change may bring us as far as the severity of rainfall in the future?
Yeah, there is suggestions, and I'm going to use the word suggestions very strongly because while we know that the Earth is warming up and we know that humans are playing an influence on that, One of the hardest things to figure out is what's going to go on with precipitation patterns. You know, and you can tell that just by looking at forecasts. I mean, that's the worst thing that we can forecast is precipitation. And so there are suggestions that storms are going to be more severe in terms of the precipitation that they have when they do happen, you know, in the 50 to 100 year time frame.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. What worries me more personally is what's going to happen to the wintertime precipitation in the region in terms of getting snowfall that can replenish the Great Lakes. That's the one thing that makes me think, sure, what's happening there?
Yeah, and another aspect of that problem, which I agree with Steve with, I think there isn't probably a broad consensus about exactly how these manifestations are going to show up locally of the global climate change. In fact, that's the revolution that's coming in our science in the next 25 to 50 years, I believe. We'll try and work more on that problem. But you mentioned runoff. I think one of the things that can be done in the current year, even without knowing if precipitation totals for a summertime are going to increase, is we can probably get a better sense of how development of land is going to contribute to runoff. I remember a few years ago there was a major flood disaster in China, and the first sense that everyone had was, oh, it must have been unusually heavy rains. And the answer was, no, it was not. It was normal summertime rains over a widespread region of China that led to real disasters because they had not managed the land right. And there's a lot of similar problems like that in China, but that's another story. They're going to have a lot of problems in this century as a result of their accelerated growth. But that might be an issue here with the runoff, is how much the land is being used in a different way.
Well, that's the crux of the issue, of course.
How do you plan for it?
Yeah, right.
Well, do you do adequate planning for it, yes?
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Marion in Greenwood, your turn now. Hi, Marion.
Well, I was inspired to call because of your caller who said she wishes sunny, clear blue skies were not presented as a beautiful day, whereas a cloudy day is a gloomy day, because all of us don't feel that way. I happen to love clouds. They're my little shelter, protection, canopy. In the winter, they keep the hot. In the summer, they keep the hot sun off of me. And in the winter, they keep me warmer. And I love a cloudy day. I'm inspired by a cloudy day. And it seems that everyone assumes we're all supposed to be inspired and invigorated by a bright, clear blue sky and a sunny day. And some of us are not. We like clouds.
Yep.
I'm with you, Marion. I'm exactly the same way. Maybe it's my Celtic soul, but that's it for me.
Yeah, I work with a bunch of weather geeks, and so, you know, when these storms go around us and we miss us, everybody's disappointed. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I feel good.
Although you take a day like yesterday.
Oh, hard to beat.
It was a sunny day in southern Wisconsin. I happened to be in the Spring Green area, and it was the hillsides and the color. And
it was spectacular, yes.
It was a spectacular day. But I tell you what, you're right, Marion. Those clouds are mean a lot to us as well, and they keep us cooler sometimes. They keep us warmer sometimes, in the right circumstances too. Ron in Grand Marais, Michigan. We'll turn to you next. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question actually on radio reception. I knew as a kid when I listened to AM, you'd get skips with different weather. But where I am up here in the central Upper Peninsula, in the summer, it seems like I haven't figured out whether it's a high pressure or low pressure comes through. I can pick up Wisconsin public radio stations really well out of Green Bay and or Sister Bay, Ellison Bay. And other times I can't get it at all. Maybe one day a week it'll come in. And it seems to be certain fronts. It seems also at that time I actually can pick up stations from Alabama and Missouri and Texas, which is really weird for FM because I always thought FM traveled in a straight line. So can you tell me why or what conditions cause good reception?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I noticed that a lot when I was a kid, or not even a kid, a young adult, let's say, when I'd be driving cross country. That sometimes you could pick up channels that were far away, and then usually at night you did that, and then during the day you didn't pick it up. And the reason why is that these radio waves get reflected high up in the atmosphere, out beyond the tropopause, which is where all the weather occurs, and then it gets reflected down. And so as you get changes in the real high, you know, I'm talking 20 to 50 miles above the surface, as those the thickness of that and the electric properties of that part of the atmosphere changes, then the radio waves as they interact with them and get reflected off of them also changes. And that's what affects what stations you can get when. So the fact that you would notice it with weather doesn't surprise me, in the sense that, you know, the atmosphere would be, you know, pulsating, if you will, as different weather systems move through. But I'm not sure, you know, whether or not that would be correlated with high pressures or low pressures.
It would be interesting to know because, you know, there might be some information you can get about what's going on at those high elevations in the atmosphere if you could really draw a correlation. I don't know.
And now I tend to notice it less because, you know, they have satellite radio you know, if you can't pick up a radio station, you just put in a CD or you get a webcast. You download iPods and you listen to Larry and, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning as I'm going across Nebraska.
Yeah. I used to love that when I was a kid, turning the Red Sox game on at night, falling asleep listening to them lose. And that doesn't happen anymore. And the AM radio would have those little like that when you had lightning in the area. Right. Even if there was nothing going on in your backyard, you knew it was coming. So that made me really excited as a kid.
Thank you, Rod. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And now with the, satellite television, DirecTV type things, apparently those video signals can be affected pretty seriously by storms.
Electrical storms, right?
Electrical storms.
Sunspot storms or something like that. I think that's one of the major things they can get.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole field that's been around for a while, but now it's getting a lot of attention in terms of space weather. And a lot of that space weather is not about precipitation. It's about electromagnetic storms that are coming from the sun and how they interact with the Earth's upper atmosphere.
Somebody phoned. By the way, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We'll have time for another question or two. Do you know anything about global dimming, as it was taken up by a Nova TV program recently? That's a question somebody had. Global dimming?
That has to do with some observations that are somewhat controversial in the sense that you know, when you're really looking at weak signals, you can look at one set of data and it can tell you one thing, and then you can look at another set of data and it'll tell you another thing. And so what the global dimming was saying was that the brightness of the Earth was actually going down because of, I think they were attributing it to aerosols, that aerosols, pollutions in the atmosphere were absorbing more of the solar radiation and thus less was being reflected back. And so the planet wasn't looking as bright. And that would contribute to global warming some more. But then other people went and took another data set and looked at that and said, no, it's not dimming. It's pretty much remaining the same in terms of the total brightness. So it's one of those areas where it got a lot of press early on. Nova picked it up, did a show, and then people went in and did more careful studies and said, hey, wait a minute, maybe this isn't what's going on.
Okay. Brad and Tomahawk, your turn. Hi, Brad.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What can we do for you?
Well, it's kind of a response to the gentleman who called in from Eau Claire. I used to live in the Twin Cities, and one of the things I've always noticed is when a storm does come in, whether it be a winter storm or a rainstorm, it always seems to split. And I believe there's been several weather people or meteorologists on TV that explain it's because there's an increase in pressure or because of all the asphalt and trapped air and whatnot within the Twin Cities, it kind of cuts through the weather system like a knife and splits it in two or pushes it north or pushes it south of the metro area. And I'm wondering if that could actually be a real factor and reason why sometimes storms, when they come to a metropolitan area, they seem to get diverted towards a smaller rural area.
Well, there are actual effects of big urban areas. One of them is the so-called urban heat island, where the temperature of that locale is a little bit higher on average during the day and a little bit warmer on average overnight than any place else in the surrounding community. To my knowledge, however, I'm not aware of how that observable characteristic of cities can relate to the movement and behavior of weather systems, particularly, I'll say, winter weather systems, because they're organized on thousand-kilometer scale. They're going to be pretty much immune to any very local effect like that. But even convective storms, I'm not quite sure how they would react to the urban heat island. So I can't confirm that there is anything to that. But I'm not really in position to deny it with the respect to the summer storms. But with the winter storms, I feel pretty strongly that there's nothing going on there.
Okay. Yeah, there have been studies to look downwind of urban islands, too, in terms of precipitation downwind seems to go down statistically. But people think that that's associated not with storms going around the cities, but rather the impact on clouds downwind because of the aerosols and pollution generally associated with cities. But yeah, I mean, once these thunderstorms develop, they're pretty big size, and it's sometimes hard to move them.
Yeah, they're big elephants in the room.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Brad. Meg in Madison, you have a quick question.
Yeah. Yes. I noticed that your caller, or I mean your guest, sounds like he's from the East Coast, and I read an incredible book called The Perfect Storm about the fishing community and where they fish and their timeline and how fishing has. We've overfished, and so they've had to go further in. And I just wanted to know, I found it totally fascinating, and actually made a movie that was very good also.
The Perfect Storm, saw that.
Actually, we're both from the East Coast.
Yeah. But I'm from closer from there. That's Gloucester, Mass. That was talked about in there. I'm from a town that's only a few miles away from Gloucester. And, it's a great part of the world, and people are attuned to the weather. And I enjoyed the book a lot more than the movie, although the book had several chapters in there that struck me as soap opera. But I wanted to get to the weather, you know, so the perfect storm came in the last few chapters. I was a little disappointed about that. But overall, I agree, it was a very good story.
What I read that book, too, and what I really liked about the weather was not so much the weather, but was about those, the Coast Guard and the rescue people.
The
heroes. The fact that these people could, you know, jump into that water to try and save somebody.
Yeah.
When you know all the fear and everything that must be associated with that, to train yourself to go and save somebody was just mind-boggling.
In the pitch black.
Yeah, right, yeah. It's just, to me, it was, that's the good side of humans.
Yeah.
Well, I am trained to end the program on time, and I thank you guys very much for being with us. You'll be back the last Monday of next month again. We'll do this all over.
Yeah, that's correct.
Absolutely. Steve Ackerman, Director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, John Martin, both professors, of course. John chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.